and welcome to Listen Up, the E3 Diagnostics podcast. I'm Julie Renshaw, Regional Sales Manager. My guest today is Dr. John Pumford, Director of Audiology and Education at AudioScan. John is the author of numerous publications that focus on hearing instrument fittings, verification, and probe microphone measurements. Previously, John held a number of clinical and research audiology positions. He's presented extensively on various audiological topics, including the focus of our conversation today. John, I'm delighted that you could join me today to discuss RECD, Couplers and Conundrums, Part 1, Back to Basics.
Thanks, Julie, for inviting me. I'm happy to be here and talk with you about this topic.
Of course, you know me, I'm anxious to jump in with all my burning RECD questions. But I think it would be very helpful if you could review the basics of the RECD measurement for us.
Sure thing. So the real ear to coupler difference, or RECD, is a concept that's been around for a number of decades, but still leads to a bit of confusion out there. Technically, it's defined as the difference in dB across frequencies between the output measured in a 2cc coupler and the output measured in an ear for a transducer delivering the same input signal in both cases. It's a mouthful, I know. And sometimes as I describe it in workshops and presentations, I can almost see people's eyes glazing over from excitement, no doubt. But in essence, what we're talking about here is a procedure that involves generating a sound, measuring it in a coupler, generating the same sound and measuring it in an ear canal, and then subtracting the difference between the two measurements. Sounds like a basic measurement, and in a lot of ways it is, but it is a very useful and powerful clinical tool.
I totally agree. It has certainly come a long way. I remember doing it in the 1990s, and we had to retrieve an insert from the sound booth and do the calculations manually.
Yes. In the past, the RECD was something clinicians needed to capture in a more haphazard fashion by jumping through various test screens, running multi-curve sweeps, and then doing the math to calculate the difference between the two curves, often by using whatever paper they had handy, no doubt. Thankfully, modern REM systems have made it a lot easier, and they've also allowed us to save a few trees in the process.
I'm all about saving trees, John.
Yeah, me too. And now we have dedicated test screens which provide guidance during the procedure with step-by-step instructions and often with screen images to make things a whole lot easier. Essentially, verification systems like the VeriFit 2 will now walk you through the coupler and real ear measures for the RECD. And best of all, they do the math for us automatically.
Whoa, thanks, John. Measurement of the RECD is so much more streamlined than when I first started doing it over 20 years ago. Audiologists often feel that RECD is for pediatrics only. Can you refresh our memory of how the RECD measurement can be applicable in all hearing aid fittings and verifications?
Sure. So to start, we should consider that the RECD is used for two purposes in the hearing aid fitting and verification process. First, it's used to convert the audiogram from dBHL to dBSPL so we can accurately figure out the patient's thresholds at the eardrum in approaches that use SPLograms, like in SpeechMap, for example. This individualized audiogram conversion leads to more accurate target generation for the patient in question, since the dBSPL thresholds that go into the formula are now personalized. In essence, it's almost like you're calibrating the audiometer for the ear canal acoustics of the patient. And there's plenty of data out there to show how the dBSPL level at the eardrum can vary across patients for the same dBHL audiometer setting. This individually measured RECD is a way with insert earphones to capture this variability.
That is so beneficial. Many audiologists are not as familiar with the role in the RECD for improving the accuracy of the HL to SPL threshold conversion when we're testing with the insert earphones.
That's right. And the second purpose of the RECD, which is often more top of mind for clinicians, is to conduct what's called simulated real ear measurements in the test box. In essence, if we know the acoustic difference between a person's ear and the measurement coupler, which the RECD provides us, we can add the RECD to any coupler or test box measure to predict on-ear performance, which can prove to be a very powerful tool and allows, for example, the pre-fitting of a hearing aid in a test box. So while the RECD, as you point out, is often considered a pediatric tool, RECD can also prove to be very valuable for any patient population. Again, for threshold conversion, but arguably more powerfully for simulated real ear measurements.
Totally agree. It is so useful.
Yep. And the nice thing, too, is we now have a bunch of research out there with various patient populations showing how accurate coupler-based simulated real ear measures with individually measured RECDs can be in predicting real ear performance, especially with minimally vented hearing aids. In fact, in a former life as a clinical audiologist in private practice, we used to routinely measure RECDs for all of our patients at the hearing aid evaluation appointment to allow us to pre-fit devices when they arrived from the manufacturer. By simply including the RECD in our test box measures, it was as if the patient's ears were in the test box and we could adjust the devices to our heart's content, fiddle with controls, ensure the product was functioning correctly, pair remote accessories, you name it, all before the patient even arrived for their hearing aid fitting.
It can be really fun to explore all the features and settings in a hearing aid without the patient sitting right there.
Yeah, it was definitely less stressful to be figuring all this stuff out without the patient sitting there in front of you, wondering if you know what you're doing. And let's say the patient did need some adjustments at the time of the hearing aid fitting. We found the pre-fitting allowed you to start from a solid foundation. So more often than not, the need for and time required for tweaking was minimized, giving the work done up front. Oh, and I almost forgot. Pre-fitting in the test box allowed us to avoid those situations where we were only finding device failures at the time of the fitting, which minimized the need to reschedule and waste the time of the patient and the clinician. So definitely a win-win.
Definitely. For someone who might be new to completing RECD, what should the clinician be mindful of to make sure that measurement is accurate?
Great question. So first things first, you want to make sure you get that coupler measurement right. And thankfully, given you're always using the same coupler with a VeriFit 2, we can quickly determine whether or not a coupler measurement is correct or not. That is, we expect a particular measurement response in a known volume for a known input signal. For this reason, VeriFit 2 systems will automatically look at the coupler response, and they'll check to see if it falls within the expected tolerance of the measurement. Should the coupler response be outside of tolerance, you'll get an error message that appears on the screen and some suggestions to help you correct the issue. And one key consideration to avoid coupler errors would be to first make sure you're using the proper coupler. As the VeriFit 2 offers more than one coupler type, we have blue 2cc couplers and silver 0.4cc couplers, each with different volumes for different purposes. Please, please make sure you use the 0.4cc silver couplers, as this is what the system expects for RECD measures. Then once you have the correct coupler, you'll want to make sure that the RECD transducer we provide is properly attached to it. In our VeriFit 2 system, this is done by attaching the trick adapters, which are like little rubber Tupperware lids, to the 0.4cc silver couplers, and then fully insert the end of the RECD transducer, delivering the signal to the top of the trick adapter, so it is flush with the inside of the lid. That is, we don't want any slit leaks.
Everyone loves the trick adapters. I mean, it's totally changed the coupling of so many different instruments. So, John, by following the steps, the coupler response soon becomes kind of a simple calibration. But what about the real ear part of RECD? Any measurement tips to help with the accuracy of that aspect?
Well, you'll definitely want to consider proper placement of the probe tube in the ear canal so that you accurately measure the SPL at the eardrum for the signal you will be presenting. There are various methods to do this, and to do the topic justice, to be honest, would require its own podcast. But in a nutshell, the general goal is to get that probe tube within 5 millimeters of the eardrum to get an accurate assessment of what's happening at the eardrum, especially in the high frequencies. This placement location can be difficult to determine, but we do have things like probe tube markers and anatomical landmarks like the intertragal notch, and you can use approaches like what the ANSI standard calls the visually assisted positioning technique to help you with this probe tube placement. There are also acoustical methods where the clinician would look for the presence of standing waves or nulls in the ear canal, not to mention lining up the probe tube alongside a patient's existing earpiece and using what's called the geometrical positioning approach. Thankfully, AudioScan has now developed a new tool, ProbeGuide, that provides on-screen guidance in the software to help clinicians with probe tube placement, and it's been validated to provide excellent results with adult ear canals.
You know, I said people love the trick adapters. Well, the probe guide's been a game changer for so many of my customers. The technology behind it is fascinating. It really has made a huge impact. So now that the probe tube is at the proper depth, thanks to the probe guide, what is the next consideration?
Well, once you have that probe tube in place, the clinician would then want to consider methods for minimizing any slit leaks that might occur when the earpiece is inserted. So basically, you'd be attaching the same RECD transducer I described earlier that was used to measure the coupler response to either a standard foam ear tip or the patient's BTE ear mold if they are being fitted with a BTE device with a regular ear mold. And then to minimize slit leaks, oftentimes you want to consider things like lubricant, so for example, Odo-Ease or Odoferm, and add that to the outside of the foam tip or the canal portion of the ear mold to fill in any gaps. By the way, while we're talking about inserting the earpiece, you'd also want to ensure that you minimize the chance that the probe tube moves from the position you've set it at previously. So to help with this, clinicians may want to think about passing the probe tube around the front of the lanyard that hangs the measurement apparatus, or what we call the probe module, on the ear to create a sort of friction that helps maintain the probe tube positioning. We've developed at AudioScan a number of videos, written guidelines that expand on this technique, not to mention visual instructions in the equipment itself if the listener wants to learn more. Suffice to say, the lanyard and lubricant are handy tools when conducting real ear measurements.
Thanks, John. Such helpful ideas. Once you've completed both the coupler response and real ear measurements and you get the RECD, any guidance regarding how we might know if we've done things correctly?
Well, it probably goes without saying that you can see some variability in the final RECD values across patients. I mean, after all, if they all looked exactly the same, there probably wouldn't be any point measuring it in the first place. But there are some general trends and things you should look for. To help with that decision making, AudioScan equipment will provide a nice reference line on the RECD test screen, which represents the age-appropriate average RECD for the patient in question. And this can be used to determine if your measurement makes sense. So if you see, say, large deviations from the RECD averages in the low frequencies on the order of 10 dB or more, that might suggest that slit leaks are present, meaning you'd want to consider solutions that minimize venting. This could involve, for example, reinserting the foam tip again more deeply, choosing a larger foam tip, or in the case of an ear mold, ensuring the vent is plugged at the medial end, since the RECD is not meant to capture vent effects. That said, deviations from the averages in the lows can be entirely acceptable in cases of a surgical ear or TM perf or for someone with PE tubes. These conditions will function to make the volume of the ear canal larger than typical and would result in a lower measured real ear response and subsequently a lower measured RECD. This is, in fact, the individual aspect we'd want to capture with an RECD measure, and you'd want to keep this result as a true response. So ultimately, consider your otoscopy and your impedance results to see if your RECD response makes sense. If you see significantly negative deviations from the averages in the high frequencies, these are usually due to things like improper probe tube placement, where the probe tube's just too far away from the eardrum. So you'd want to check your placement using otoscopy, reinsert the probe tube more deeply if appropriate, and remeasure to see if the response is in fact accurate. In some systems as well, you will, though, see roll-off of the high-frequency RECDs from the averages when you're using ear molds, for example, and this, in fact, would be expected, as the tubing in the ear mold will roll off the signal, resulting in a lower real ear measurement in the high frequencies and therefore a lower RECD. So in these cases, a deviation in the high frequencies would make a lot of sense and should be accepted.
So it's essential to be mindful of slit leaks and make sure the probe is positioned correctly. So how often would you suggest clinicians remeasure the RECD?
Yeah, we often get that question. If we look to the research, it suggests that the RECD should be remeasured whenever there is a change in the ear canal or middle ear status. So often with younger patients, for example, an easy trigger to remeasure the RECD would be the changing of ear molds, which is quite frequent at a younger age as the dimensions of the ear canal change due to growth. Once that outer and or middle ear has changed or reached adult status and is no longer in flux, in general, the need for remeasuring is lessened. Now, it is difficult to determine an exact age where this stability occurs. I personally tend to consider the age-appropriate RECD norms from a validated generic fitting formula like DSL to determine a rough cutoff. But of course, at any age, there can be changes in ear canal acoustics due to things like surgery, PE tubes, or perforation of the eardrum. So again, definitely otoscopy and impedance results can be a friend in this regard and inform your decision making to see whether your RECD measures make sense. But when in doubt, I'd simply err on the side of remeasuring, since with practice, RECD measures are such a quick measure to complete. If you have any reason to believe the status of the outer or middle ear has changed, to accurately capture the new volume and impedance that is present, you'd want to remeasure the RECD and then subsequently remeasure should these issues change once more.
Thanks, John. Ear mold venting and open fits are also a question when measuring the RECD using the actual coupling method to the hearing aid. Can you offer your opinion on this issue as well?
Sure. So regarding ear mold venting, I need to point out that the RECD at its core is not meant to capture vent effects. So any ear mold used to deliver the test signal for the real ear portion of the RECD should be plugged and should be plugged at the medial end to ensure the signal does not interact with the acoustics of the vent on the medial side. With the common application of the RECD to younger ears, ear canals are often too small to have a vent in the BTE ear mold anyway, so this isn't an issue. But with larger ear canals, again, you wouldn't want to have a vented earpiece to deliver the signal for the RECD in the application of this measurement per the ANSI standard. As I said earlier, if there's any venting, this would show up in the measured response as a negative deviation in the low frequency response. Also, as I mentioned before, the RECD is used for audiometric conversion from DBHL audiograms to DBSPL at the eardrum. Given there shouldn't be any venting in a hearing test with insert phones, you definitely wouldn't want it in your RECD. Otherwise, the mathematical conversions would all be messed up.
Okay, yeah. So the rule of thumb has always been to use measured rather than averaged RECDs when possible. Although you've touched on this briefly, I get this question all the time, and can you further discuss and confirm the best practice in the case of tubes, perforations, and middle ear effusion?
So first off, as you say, in an ideal world, you'd always want to use measured RECDs whenever possible in the conversion for thresholds and for simulated real ear. Now, while the averages have become significantly better over time with the benefit of additional research, we do know there's significant variability that is often difficult to predict across frequencies in the RECD, not only between children and adults, which can be on the order of 20 dB or more, but also within a particular age group, including adults. While there are likely some people out there with average ear canals, I still haven't found a way to look at somebody and know if they have an average ear canal. So short of that, you're going to want to measure whenever is possible. And so if we carry this forward to individuals with tubes or perforations or surgical ears and so on, no doubt they're definitely not average in terms of their ear canal acoustics, and we would definitely want to measure that unique acoustic signature of their ear canal to accurately convert the hearing test results and accurately simulate the real ear performance of their hearing aid in a test box. Once that outer and middle ear canal condition resolved itself, we would then advise that the RECD be remeasured and then be used to reflect their new acoustic signature.
Acoustic signature. I like that terminology, John. Now we are ready to accurately program the hearing aid. Basics of RECD completed. This concludes part one of this two-part series on RECD. couplers, and conundrums back to basics. John, I really appreciate your expert insight for all of my questions. Stay tuned for part two, RECD Couplers and Conundrums to NC and Beyond. Listeners, if you have any questions or comments, please feel free to contact your local E3 sales representative or send John an email at john.pumford@audioscan.com. Thank you so much, John, for being a part of our podcast.
Thank you so much, Julie. I really enjoyed my time speaking with you today.